The words, the following program contains violent content that may be disturbing. Viewer discretion is advised, appear, followed by February 11th, 2020.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Berman, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Today, we announce criminal charges against this man, Lawrence Ray, who for nearly a decade exploited and abused young women and men emotionally, physically, and sexually for his own financial gain.
An image of Larry Ray looking thoughtful appears.
Who is Larry Ray? Nobody really knows.
Ray has been charged with 9 counts, including sex trafficking, extortion, forced labor, and money laundering.
The words Peacock Original appear in white letters.
He was a master manipulator, a master con man. But every single relationship he had was based on a fraud.
Words read, this is the story of elite college students.
Larry has filled this void for the kids of having a parental figure that was there for them and wanted to listen to them.
Words read, brainwashed into a cult.
Investigators claim that Ray groomed the roommates, conducting therapy sessions.
He would talk about how to be the best person that you can be in some weird theory called quest for potential.
He manipulated them into making their worlds smaller and smaller until they were totally dependent upon him.
How could these bright young students have gone along with this?
Larry tells them they have to work all day.
They become profit centers. He has them literally drain the bank accounts of their parents.
Ray initially befriended his victims, moving into their on-campus housing before encouraging them the summer after their sophomore year to move in with him to a Manhattan apartment.
He would begin to instruct them to have sex with each other and do various things that they weren't comfortable with.
Words read, this is a tale of deception, coercion, and terror.
Larry has to force her to continue being a prostitute.
We're dealing with brain control, mind control. We're looking at a con artist on steroids.
A home video shows Larry in a dressing gown kicking in a bedroom door and grabbing someone. The screen goes black. Ripples appear from an image of Larry staring out. The title, Sex, Lies and the College Cult, appear in red letters beneath the words, Peacock Original. Words read, in 2018 a young journalist in Brooklyn, New York uncovered a strange website. Exterior view of a row of buildings. A young man sits at a laptop.
I was looking for a story I could work on. A friend of mine had gone to her 5-year reunion at Sarah Lawrence. People at the reunion were gossiping about these rumors about what had happened to some of these kids who they'd gone to school with.
Writer Ezra Marcus's face appears.
And somebody had found this website. It was pretty unsettling. It had a lot of different headers that were called things like, I poisoned people because my mother told me to, or I am a liar and I am working for the government, and there was a link to this video.
Subtitles read, Sunday, March 22nd. Please talk audibly, Claudia. It's Sunday, March 22nd.
It's Sunday, March 22nd.
This girl was sort of being interviewed.
A tired-looking woman appears. Words read, this video was made under duress. Subtitles read, start from the most current time backwards. The most current time. And first, are you making this by your own free will?
Yes.
Anybody pay you? No. Anybody threaten you? No. Anybody coerce you? No.
It begins with Claudia saying, I'm making this of my own free will. Which is first of all like, if you have to say that, you're probably not.
The woman stares at the camera. Subtitles read, okay, so when did you poison last? She covers her mouth with her hands.
And a man is off camera asking her questions in this deep voice, an older man's voice.
Subtitles read, so you're saying you put mercury on where? On the doorknobs in the hospital? Yeah, she pauses before the subtitles continue. Your food, other things I touched or anybody touched? Yeah, she closes her eyes and puts her face in her hands.
It was clear that something weird was going on. My thinking about it turned from, oh, is Claudia this, like, you know, evil poisoner, which was how the website presented her, into something wrong is being done to her by this guy. And, you know, that's the first time I kind of encountered Larry Ray.
Daylight aerial view of a city.
I just started reaching out to people that were named on the website to talk to them about what had been going on with Claudia and what had happened to her. And I pitched it to New York Magazine on the initial striking thing, which was that a man moved into his daughter's dorm room.
The years appear in white letters and fly back from 2018 to 2010. Aerial view of a large brick building. The words, Sarah Lawrence College, Bronxville, New York, appear.
Sarah Lawrence is a small liberal arts college in upstate New York where people are really dedicated to learning and are extremely intelligent. It's a very hard school to get into.
It seems to attract young people who are interested in the arts, interested in literature, interested in theater maybe.
I wanted to study literature, so I went there. It was beautiful, leafy green campus, and it was not too far from the city.
The words, fall semester 2010, appear.
Tali Ray grew up in New Jersey. She was a really driven student.
She had this group of friends that she moved in with sophomore year into a campus housing.
And they were freestanding houses, all kind of arranged in a row, pathway from this little forest. They were gonna have fun, hang out, make food together, throw some parties. Classic sophomore year of college stuff.
Three U's smile out from a picture labeled Government Exhibit 19. Photographs of the individual students appear.
Daniel Levin was from New Jersey. He was kind of a shy kid, but he was excited to make new friends. He wanted to be a writer, I believe.
Then there's Santos Rosario, which was Talia's former boyfriend turned friend and roommate.
His parents owned a travel agency in the Bronx, a small family business. It was the American dream. Claudia was from Los Angeles. She was super creative. She liked to tell stories. You know, her friends from high school thought of her as gregarious, and, you know, she'd also had a really sheltered kind of childhood.
And then there's Isabella Pollock.
She was from San Antonio, very far away from home. She was pretty shy, also pretty sheltered. She and Talia quickly really bonded and became, like, really close friends.
A fan turns as someone types on a laptop.
The group of students who were Talia's housemates were, you know, 18, 19 years old.
Dr. Yanyala Lich speaks.
Most of them from good families, good academic backgrounds. What's important to remember, the human brain is not fully developed until you're 25 years old. So that's a very vulnerable period.
They definitely were all trying to figure out who they were and where they belonged in this world at college, kind of leaning on each other to try to figure out what they were supposed to be doing.
Exterior daytime view of brick buildings nestled among trees.
When Talia showed up at Sarah Lawrence and met this group, her dad was a central part of her conversations. She would describe how he was this amazing, smart person that she idolized. He is an extremely important person who had all these important connections in New York.
She painted him as someone who had been wrongly pursued by law enforcement because he had powerful enemies.
She described him as some political martyr who'd taken on corruption and been punished and was in jail. When she was 7, Larry and Tali's mother, Teresa, got divorced. And the custody dispute quickly turned extremely nasty. Years later, Talia refuses to live with her mom. And at a certain point, Larry and Talia essentially go on the run. They're tracked down by US Marshals, and, you know, they burst through the door and arrest Larry.
Larry Ray goes to jail for the child custody dispute. The way that Talia describes her father to her friends at Sarah Lawrence is that he's been wrongfully accused of this child custody dispute and shouldn't be in jail, hates her mother for putting him there. Talia is obsessed with Larry. He is the perfect dad ever, and he's been wrongfully convicted.
One day she basically says, my dad is getting out of prison and you needed a place to kind of land after getting out of jail. She was like, yeah, my dad's gonna come visit and maybe, you know, spend the night and, yeah.
The words, Larry is released from prison and arrives at Talia's dorm to meet her friends appear.
It's totally not unusual for parents to drop by colleges and even spend the night sometimes. And then he kind of stayed.
I think the initial reaction was probably their gut reaction and should have been one that they listened to. It was like, why is this grown man in our college dorm room? This is weird.
But he sort of installed himself in the common room as like a father figure for the dorm.
I thought he was very cool, very smart, very composed, and very inspirational.
He was very friendly, and he seemed, you know, sort of very different from anyone, like very magnetic, charismatic kind of personality.
He'd make dinner for everyone, or he'd order food, these kind of lavish meals. You know, you're a college student, that's awesome. So kids would kind of hang out with him and listen to him talk, and he'd give these almost sort of like lectures at night in the common room.
So I think that while their immediate reaction was like, Talia, why did you just bring your father into our house? Quickly translated to Talia, I can't imagine your father not being in this house.
Being in college is a uniquely vulnerable point in the life of a lot of people. You're away from home for the first time. You're in a strange place, not exactly sure what you're doing.
It was really hard for me. I was not really prepared to live alone. I had, like, never done laundry before going to college. I had a lot of separation anxiety from my parents. I just felt very sort of anchorless and anxious and didn't really have a good handle on myself.
Larry sold himself as an expert in self-improvement, some sort of combination of a life coach and therapist.
Somebody tells you, I got the answers, and can do it in a confident way, is in a position to exert undue influence. I have exactly the answer, and I am the bridge to mental health for you. And that can be powerful.
I'm having anxiety and all these problems. And Santos was like, why don't you talk to Larry? He's great. He's been helping me.
I ended up confiding in him a lot about issues that I have with my family, my depression that I struggled with in high school.
Larry really listened and really, really seemed as though he actually very much wanted to help me. I shared a lot of very personal things.
He spoke a lot about inspirational things like honesty, principles, science and philosophy. I considered him a very honest and truthful person. And initially, I felt it was important to me to be a good person, you know, be like him, be honest and be truthful.
The words quest for potential appear in white letters.
You talk about how to be the best person that you can be and how everybody has a potential that they can achieve. Some weird theory called quest for potential.
Actors read victim statements.
He framed it as helping them optimize and helping them get over their insecurities and become happier, more effective people.
Larry promised young people who were very confused and felt alienated that he was the person who was going to pull them out of it.
He's helping them reveal hidden truths about themselves and changing the programming that their evil parents and evil society, all these things that were sort of done to them, and he's intentionally changing their mindset.
Larry said that he had extensive military training in the mind and human behavior from different departments of the government, so DOD, FBI, CIA, DIA, Marine Corps.
The sort of climax of it would be these stories about his heroic past.
Larry claimed to the kids that he helped negotiations to end the war in Kosovo. He claimed to be related to Al Capone. The list goes on.
He was very good at myth-making about himself.
I think if you were to sit Larry Ray down and ask him the question, Larry, who are you? I think he'd con you in his own answer, because I'm not sure Larry Ray knows who he really is. Larry Ray is someone who can become whoever you want him to be and whoever he needs you to think he is.
The years appear in white letters and fly back from 2010 to 1959. A row of buildings is shown with the words, Bay Bridge, Brooklyn, New York.
Larry Ray is Larry Greco, one thing. It's the name he was born under.
Larry grew up in Brooklyn. I mean, if you hear him, he's a quintessential Brooklyn boy.
At a certain point, his parents divorced and mom remarried a man named Gordon Ray, and Larry took his stepfather's last name. He served in the military for 19 days, and he was discharged for reasons that are unclear. He married his high school sweetheart, Teresa.
He's known a lot of people. He's known a lot of connected people. He seems to sort of fit in where he goes, whether that be law enforcement or reportedly he had some mafia connections in Brooklyn.
He seemingly knew everybody, really good friends with Bernie Carrick.
Bernard Carrick's face appears.
Bernie Carrick was the New York City police commissioner.
And he was somebody Giuliani had brought up from just being an undercover cop into being like a, you know, high-ranking member of the administration.
In 1995, I met Larry Ray. We would work out together. We'd have coffee, have lunch. He was extremely charismatic. He was very smart, very, very smart.
It's this sort of like mutually beneficial business relationship, but it's also a real friendship. Larry's the best man at Bernie's wedding.
Looking back, it's kind of strange. You know, you get married, you have all these wedding photos, and I've got 1,000 wedding photos, and not one has my best man in it. They've all been discarded.
And Larry Ray helped Carrick broker an introduction between Rudy Giuliani and Mikhail Gorbachev.
Larry was flying into JFK, and he comes out of the international terminal. And he says, Bern, I want you to meet President Gorbachev. I said, okay, all right. I told the mayor, I said, Gorbachev is here. He'd love to see you if you have a minute. And Giuliani said, absolutely, bring him down.
Giuliani sits with Gorbachev in an office.
For a politician like Rudy Giuliani, that kind of photo op is worth more than its weight in gold.
It was pretty slick.
Gorbachev, Bernard, and Larry stand together in a photograph. Aerial view of the college buildings. The words, November 2010 Sarah Lawrence College, appear with an external view of a window.
You've got this guy who just spent years in prison. He lands in this dorm with these young, vulnerable, eager roommates of his daughter who adores him, who basically set them up to like him. And so for him, you can see where his little wheels are turning and thinking, oh.
Isabella was clearly the closest to Talia and the closest to Larry. And Larry would often sleep in Isabella's room.
Ray told residents of the apartment that she needed help. She needed supervision, essentially. You know, instead of it being something sexual, he was really just there to supervise her through the night.
I was pretty freaked out at first. I didn't really know what to think. I thought it was weird. He got her, like, this coat that she really loved that was, like, significantly more elegant than her other clothing. So she seemed to, like, actually open up more after meeting him. He just said that he was helping her through some psychological issues or emotional issues she was having.
And then, at the end of that semester, Isabella's parents get a phone call from Larry.
A dramatization shows a man on the phone.
He said, if she comes home for Christmas, she's going to be reliving trauma and she's going to kill herself.
He told them that, you know, Isabella didn't feel safe with him. That was a complete shock.
He was breaking her from her family. The purpose is separating you from friends and family, any support system you may have had. And obviously making the decision for her that she wasn't going to go home. And Isabella isn't protesting that. So the family gets completely flummoxed, like, what the hell's going on here?
But their hands were kind of tied. I mean, you can't take an adult away from a situation she wanted to be in.
And so it's the beginning of breaking everyone off from anyone else.
The words, in December 2010, Sarah Lawrence closes for winter break. To strengthen his hold over Isabella, Larry needs a favor from a friend.
My name is Lee Chen. I'm a businessman based primarily here in Manhattan.
Lee Chen's face appears in black and white.
When I first remember meeting Larry Ray, he was a person with a commanding presence. We had engaged in several business dealings. He seemed like a very kind person. I thought that he was caring, and he exhibited signs that he had a lot of compassion. There was a time during Christmas break, Larry had brought back to my apartment not only Talia, but also Isabella Pollock.
Larry would take them out to these like lavish dinners. He'd often pay in cash. He had all this cash in his backpack. Larry is in control of everything. What they eat, where they go, what they do. And there's a really odd kind of dynamic between Larry and Isabella, which seems really sexual, even though it's supposedly all about helping her.
What he was doing was establishing full control. He's away from the campus, any like people saying what the hell's going on there. And so he is reinforcing that separation from the outside world.
Exterior night view of a tall apartment with balconies on every floor. The words, Lee Chen is frequently traveling or staying with a girlfriend, but he periodically sleeps at his apartment, appear.
Often, I wasn't there because I had been traveling for business. When I came back from the trip, he had moved himself into my bedroom. But it wasn't just him. And it wasn't just him and Talia. I only had one bed in my bedroom. It was him, Talia, and Isabella. And they were sleeping in my bed, all together.
Larry's stroking Isabella's hair on the bed and calling her his baby girl. She's, what, 19, maybe 20? This man's in his 50s. You know, she's sleeping in his bed every night so he can help her, whatever that means.
It was methodically choosing one person who became totally dependent on him and then could sort of systematically work through the rest of the people.
Blurred images of other students flash by. Aerial view of the bare tops of trees in a forest in winter. The words, January 2011, appear, followed by, Claudia, Santos and Daniel move back to the dorm for spring semester. Pictures of the three are shown. The words, Talia, Isabella and Larry join them, follow, along with pictures of the young women and Larry.
Larry has filled this void for the kids of having a parental figure that was there for them and wanted to listen to them and had time for them.
Someone stirs a coffee.
Daniel was coming to him with some of his insecurities, and he had a pretty normal question, which was he was struggling with his sexuality. You know, am I straight or gay? Larry, in a very definitive way, said, you're not gay. You know, you're straight.
And once Larry knew that, Larry was able to really use that against Daniel. And use that in Daniel's relationship with his family and his father.
Daniel's dad wrote to him in an email, it's like you're hypnotized when I talk to you. It's like, what's up with you? You know, there was a real shift in these people's outward personalities. Isabella's aunt and her mother flew to New York and they had dinner with Isabella and Larry. And Larry was just seemed very much to be kind of in control of the conversation. And Isabella seemed to just kind of go along with whatever he said. So, you know, they went back to San Antonio.
The history of this case is replete with people trying their best to draw the attention of authorities. Some 50-year-old guy's living in the dorm. It's strange.
Some of the parents thought it was pretty weird, especially as the situation progressed. The parents said that they made complaints to the school administrators.
Parents writing to, speaking with Sarah Lawrence officials. At least one student communicating with the dean of students. We've got an issue here.
Words appear saying the producers have contacted Sarah Lawrence College regarding these complaints. In a statement, they said, the proof at trial established that these criminal acts took place in a private apartment in New York City and in North Carolina, not on the Sarah Lawrence campus. To suggest anything to the contrary is neither factual nor fair to the dedicated staff who were here at that time, or to the victims of Ray's horrendous behavior. With respect to that recently concluded prosecution, the college has fully cooperated with all requests for documents and information. People cross a busy street. The date July 2011 appears, followed by the words, with the school year over, Larry returns to Chen's apartment.
The next summer, Larry had started to bring more and more students into my home.
Dan, Claudia, and Santos were kind of like the newer acolytes, the ones who were kind of more recently falling under the sway of Larry and seeking him out for guidance. And so they sort of all end up living there.
Larry, Isabella, and Talia shared the bedroom. And in the living room, we got two king-size blow-up mattresses, which we would put on the ground, and they would completely cover the ground. And then there was a longer couch and a shorter couch.
It's a one-bedroom apartment, but there's like multiple people sleeping there. There's not enough space for everybody.
Someone eats from a fast food box.
Many times when I'd come back from a trip, whether it be business or personal, I'd find all these people in my living room and Larry standing there like a general talking to his assembled troops.
They're really now what I call a self-sealed system. You're closed to the outside world. You may be living in the middle of Manhattan, but you're in an altered reality.
Larry Ray took it upon himself to study cults. He wanted to hone and refine his con skills and turn them into cult development skills.
Aerial evening view of a city skyline overlooking a river. The view zooms in on roofs and then on a single large apartment building.
He would start every morning by playing the song to wake them up, and it would be like, okay, you know, Larry's in charge.
A blurred scene shows students waking in the morning.
He was the day-in, day-out ringleader of what this group was doing. He would talk about how to be the best person that you can be and how everybody has a potential that they can achieve. So he'd tell you what to do. He'd tell you what was wrong with you. The sort of climax of it would be these nighttime sort of sessions where they would sit around and talk.
It sounded like there was very little sleep, sitting around all hours of the night, analyzing themselves and analyzing each other ad nauseum. He was starting to test them in ways that would really push them.
The discussions would become like focused on one person. This long, drawn-out period of interrogation, basically with them at first denying, and then eventually, after hours, confessing to having done something wrong.
He kept calling me a liar, saying that what I was saying wasn't true and that I should give him a list of things that I did wrong. And he would periodically have me affirm how I harmed him throughout the day or throughout the time that I knew him.
He was brainwashing them by forcing them to over and over again, under pressure, admit to doing things that they hadn't done until they either believed it or said that they believed it.
And that instead of using those stories to help people feel better about themselves, he turned them around and used them to humiliate people and to control them.
How could these bright young students have gone along with this? It's the months of indoctrination to the point where they have internalized the beliefs and the behaviors that Larry has been imparting to them.
Pressure would ratchet up, where it wouldn't just be about like you know, how can we help this person's mental health? It would be like, what did this person do to disrupt the group?
Personally, I felt like everyone only spoke to me because Larry, you know, told them to. He actually told me they only spoke to me because he told them to multiple times. So I felt very ostracized and on thin ice.
He manipulated them into making their worlds smaller and smaller until they were totally dependent upon him.
Aerial daytime view of Sarah Lawrence College. The main building sits snugly amongst trees as the city looms in the background. The words, September 2011, appear in white letters, followed by, Talia Ray moves back to Sarah Lawrence alone. Talia smiles in a photograph. Text reads, meanwhile, a new person joins the other cult members in Manhattan. An image of Ibon Gokwa Choa appears.
Ibon Gokwa Choa was a former boyfriend of Talia's.
Text reads, Talia had introduced Ibon to her father years before going to Sarah Lawrence.
And he spent a lot of time in the apartment. He was very much part of the group.
Ibon was just very, very easy to be around. Smile was electric. He had a gift for breaking tension and just making the mood light.
He saw Larry as kind of a mentor and a guiding light who had looked after him. He believed that Larry was sort of this example of this heroic Marine that he wanted to emulate. He enlisted in the Marines, which Larry pushed him to do, even though Larry was not in the Marines. And by the time of the students living in the apartment, he's come back from serving in Afghanistan. He'd been through some really traumatizing things in Afghanistan. He'd seen some people close to him die, and he was experiencing PTSD.
I felt that Larry had placed himself in a position where Ibon saw him as a factor in his treatment. And I think it's something that Larry took advantage of.
Daytime view of New York buildings.
Sometimes I'd be hanging out with Ibon, and he'd just like pick up the phone, yes, yes, boom, hang up, and then he's like, gotta go. Be like, oh, he's got to be ready at all times.
He often played a role of sort of like a gopher. Larry would have him drive him around. As I was reporting the story, I spoke with Ibon. When I talked to him, it was in 2019.
Subtitles read, he's helped me through a lot of emotional battles that I had. Directing me and guiding me, I should say. He was there for me to help me, sort of get my bearings again when I came back to civilian society.
He kind of saw himself as on a mission for Larry. And it was his duty to, if Larry ever needed anything, in the same way as he would obey a commander in the military, he would do what Larry needed.
Exterior view of a tall building behind a tree.
As time passed, Larry began to also test them with physical violence. In the beginning, sort of small things that weren't necessarily scary, like shoving. And then as time went on, these things became actually violent.
Larry described how, like, Ibon had come to some sort of very critical turning point in his processing or therapy. And in order to push him towards the right decision, Larry, like, took the edge of a spatula and pressed into his neck and told him it was a knife and told him he was going to die and he should just let go of whatever psychological thing he was holding on to.
Text reads, as Larry's violence escalates, he begins recording videos.
Larry was an obsessive documentarian of what his life was comprised of and what the victims were doing and what they owed him.
Larry would hit them or make them do things while simultaneously firing off questions and forcing them to admit things that they didn't even know existed until that second.
Text appears. Daniel becomes the focus of one horrific encounter. Ray holds a wrench to Daniel's mouth. Subtitles read, "Give me your tongue. Stick it out. Stick out your tongue. Next it's gonna be the head of your. You understand? See this how it feels? What if I picked you up like that? Picked you up by your tongue? You're a grown man. I'm a grown man. I don't like what you did. Now one more time and I'm gonna split your tongue in half. You doubting me, Danny?"
Mm-hmm. "Now one more time and I'm gonna split your tongue in half. You doubting me, Danny?"
"No." Larry Ray is the epitome of a malignant narcissist.
A dramatization shows one person shoving another.
He is vengeful. He is mean. He is motivated by power. And he is dangerous. These narcissists are so full of themselves, and they want to record everything as proof of what they're able to accomplish.
He was starting to advise them on their sex lives and begin to put pressure on them to be more open sexually.
And I think a lot of it for Larry, it was about using sex as sort of a tool to destabilize them, make them uncomfortable. It was a tactic.
It's a way to hook someone in. You know, how could you be more honored than to have the revered person wanting to have a sexual relationship? It's one of the deepest, most intimate ways to control someone.
Larry came out of the bedroom, and it was just us in the living room, and like stood over me, started grabbing himself, like, under his pants, and started talking about, like, orgasms and how he could make me orgasm without touching. He also suggested that Dan and I have sex right there. And when he left, we did. And Yvonne was, like, next to us.
Larry really targeted and humiliated Daniel because of his issue of sexual exploration.
A close-up of male legs wearing lace appears.
And he told Daniel to go in the other room and put on a dress. It's one of the women's dresses. And so in front of everybody, he's making fun of him in this dress.
And then he asked Isabella to bring out a sex toy and then told Daniel to try and put that into himself in front of the whole group. And they all sort of stood around making fun of him for this.
You can imagine the trauma for Daniel to have to go through such an experience of shame and humiliation.
He just got bolder and bolder. As it snowballed, it became this cult he could completely control.
The words "Fall 2011" appear against a tall building.
Lee Chen is growing increasingly disturbed by what's happening here. And it's not just the mental and physical abuse he's witnessing, it's also what Larry's doing in his apartment.
Someone opens the lid of a paint can.
Larry had asked me to help him reorganize the apartment because it was a mess, and repaint the walls of the foyer and remodel the bathroom.
And it quickly devolves into Larry wanting to fix this one-bedroom apartment. And it's up to these kids to fix it for him. I mean, Santos Rosario was a 19-year-old kid. He does not know how to fix walls or do manual labor or home improvement.
Larry had completely changed the appearance of my apartment. He took down walls, painted the foyer pink, and left electrical wires hanging in the breeze. It was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. Larry had never paid me any rent. I'd gotten completely fed up. And I told him, "I don't want to hear it. And you have to get out." I sent him 10-day notice to leave. But that's when he changed the locks on my apartment, so I could no longer get into my own home. I took Larry to New York County Civil Court. It took me over 3 years to gain an eviction judgment.
If somebody wrote a Larry Ray novel, it would never get published because your publisher would say, it's too much. It's too much. That can never happen. Never. Nobody's going to believe this. So go back and do it all over again because it's not going to work. That's the only way to describe the insanity of Larry Ray's con ability, if you will.
I think the way that Larry always wanted to be was the way that he portrayed himself to other people. He really wanted to be important.
Over the course of the 90s, we can really see Larry and Bernie kind of riding high together. It's mutually beneficial, where Carrick gets Larry's connections to meet influential people and kind of advance his rise. Meanwhile, Larry is using Carrick's influence for meeting as many powerful people as possible and playing them off each other. And then things kind of went south.
Larry Ray does not discriminate on getting access to powerful players, and that includes organized crime members.
The year 2000 appears against New York buildings.
Larry Ray served as a confidential source for the FBI, talking about a $40 million Wall Street scheme.
He's aware of a Wall Street fraud connected to the Gambino crime family.
But Larry is putting himself out as informant to cover his own role in the scheme. Eventually, the FBI catches on that, wait a minute, our informant is actually part of this crime.
20 people arrested, including stockbrokers and alleged associates of the Gambino crime family.
My cell phone rings. Larry calls me, tells me he's been arrested. And he wanted to see me and wanted me to help him. No, you don't understand. The FBI's got it wrong and all this other stuff. You know, can you call the U.S. attorney? Can you call a judge? I said, I'm not doing any of that. You know, you're indicted. I can't get involved.
Text reads, Larry pleads guilty to securities fraud.
He's sentenced to 5 years of probation with the caveat that, you know, if he commits more crimes during this, he'll be in prison.
Larry doesn't take that well. In Larry Ray's mind, Bernie Carrick owed him. He made Bernie Carrick. Larry decides, I'm going to take out my revenge. And that takes the form of calling the media. He starts talking about ethics violations that Bernie Carrick might be involved in.
Ray was a one-time felon turned FBI informant, but he turned on Carrick, telling authorities how Carrick took $150,000 in free apartment renovations from a mob-linked construction firm.
Some of it was checks, some was cash.
Carrick went to prison.
I blame all of it on Larry Ray. He started the investigation that eventually resulted in me going to prison. And he was very proud of it.
The year 2007 appears, followed by illegally taking custody of Talia, Larry violates his probation. Larry is sentenced to 3 years in prison. An evening view of a prison yard surrounded by barbed wire is shown.
By the time Larry gets out of jail in 2010, he is completely alone. I think any sort of connection he used to have is gone. He is no longer of any importance in the city. But it's fascinating because the way that Talia described him to her friends, her freshman year of college at Sarah Lawrence, is that he still has that power.
Larry pulls Bernie Carrick out when he starts telling the college students, really powerful people coming after him.
Overhead view of the Sarah Lawrence College buildings. The words Fall 2011 New York City appear in white on a black background. Evening images of New York City apartments are shown, focusing in on one.
Santos Rosario, he had two sisters.
His 22-year-old sister smiles in a picture.
Yalitza attended Columbia as an undergraduate.
Santos' 29-year-old sister is shown.
Felicia has gone to Harvard, and she's now doing her medical residency in Los Angeles.
She was well on her way to a successful life with a meaningful career. Santos had expressed interest in connecting Felicia with Larry because he felt Larry was helping him identify his issues and overcome them, and he wanted his sister Felicia to get the same benefit.
And, you know, she's introduced to Larry and begins talking to him at length on the phone.
A blurred image shows people talking on phones.
Felicia was essentially recruited and groomed long distance.
We were on the phone together. Oh, I thought he was really nice, charming, smart. We ended up talking every day, multiple times a day. So we were friendly. We talked about my siblings a lot because he was spending a lot of time with them. Then it got to be romantic.
And Larry plays off of that and gets her to kind of do things that she's not comfortable with.
At first, he asked about how many people I slept with. Then what kind of sex did I like? Who did I like to sleep with? That was at first. He insisted that I was to go out and have sex with strangers.
While she was still living in Los Angeles, working on her residency, Felicia started fulfilling these sexual requests for Larry. She believed she was in a relationship with him, and she didn't want to do any of that and pushed back. But ultimately, he convinced her that she would do these things if she loved him.
Larry also wanted to see me having sex with someone else, and he wanted me to record it. Larry wouldn't stop asking. He was getting more angry, and so I decided I would comply and appease him. I didn't want to, though.
It's remarkable that someone like Felicia, with her education and her life experience, that she got sucked in so completely and so quickly.
You have to ask yourself, how does that happen? Felicia was most likely in a vulnerable place at that point. She's in her medical residency. That's tough. Perhaps learned enough from Santos of the things that would make her more suggestible to his, whatever he was saying on the phone to her. It really shows how good he was at what he did, which is what some of the people in his previous lives had said about him.
Text reads, Larry Ray convinces Felicia that she is in danger in Los Angeles.
He talked about how he had helped bring down Bernard Carrick and basically put him in jail, and that now Bernard Carrick and others were after him and were trying to hurt him. He talked about how the people who were trying to hurt him would target everyone who he was associated with or cared about. I had become extremely paranoid. I was terrified that people were going to come and kill me. I was just scared out of my mind. I couldn't sleep.
She goes from being somebody who is like on a really solid upward trajectory to somebody who has moved her mattress into the living room and installed cameras around her apartment that Larry encouraged her to buy and set up because she's afraid that people are out to get her. He really preys on this to induce her to leave her residency and abandon her dreams of being a doctor. She just drops all of this because she's afraid and in love and thinks that Larry can protect her. And so she moves to New York and moves into the apartment.
The date October 2012 is shown against the apartment building. Text reads, Larry also coerces Yalitza to join her brother and sister in the apartment on 93rd Street.
Do you want to hurt yourself? What?
I don't want to.
What?
I don't want to hurt myself.
I don't know. Why was it so difficult to say that? Is that accurate?
No, I have no idea. I still want to.
And how have you been thinking about hurting yourself?
These young people were very much hostages in a very real sense.
Santos went through some awful emotional, physical, psychological abuse.
So there's a video of Santos slapping himself in the face while his sister, Felicia, is next to him on the couch, and she's appears to be really unwell and is kind of freaking out.
Santos spends an hour slapping himself in the face pretty hard.
Stop talking, Felicia.
He was doing this because Larry told him it was the only way to get his sister, Felicia, to stop talking or to be quiet.
I think Larry was able to justify in his brain as someone was helping me.
Subtitles, can I get up now? No, Felicia, stop talking.
Larry would pit one of his followers against another and use them to shame each other and police each other, to just drill feelings of guilt and shame into the minds of his followers.
Subtitles, I want to go change my clothes. Like, I don't want to be in here. So excuse me, Isabella, do not leave it. Do not leave the room, Felicia. You're a danger to yourself and others, clearly.
Felicia was favored early on, which can make you feel very special. Like, oh, this incredible man is in a relationship with me. And then he just most brutally destroyed her.
Felicia, lay down.
Watching Larry physically overpower her and physically restrain her. And restrain her really in every way, physically and emotionally. It was a long, drawn-out, tortured conditioning period.
Subtitles, are you gonna behave? Felicia lays on the floor. The apartment building is shown at night.
I was terrified. He said he would help me. I felt it was too much for me. The concept of being that bad of a person was just intolerable.
Subtitles read, so I'm going back to bed.
So then I went ahead and I tried to end it. I was in the bathroom and I saw a bottle of pills.
Felicia turns off the tap. Subtitles read, Isabella, I hear a pill bottle opening and closing. Ray starts to kick down the bathroom door.
And then Larry had gotten up. He realized I was out of bed. And he came, slammed the door open from the bathroom, and then yanked me by the hair.
Subtitles. Spit them out. Spit them.
And then said to Isabella, don't let this fucking cunt kill herself in my apartment.
Text reads, Felicia and her sister Yalitza will both attempt suicide during their time with the group.
At least three of the women tried to commit suicide. And that's not surprising, given what they were enduring. It's beyond comprehension what was being done to them. And of course, it seems only natural that they would reach a point where they just couldn't take it anymore.
Suicide becomes an overriding theme where Larry tells them, all of you are prone to suicide. There's been so many suicide attempts among you. You are all uniquely at risk, and only I can save you.
The apartment building's windows are lit up in the dark. Text reads, June 2012. Iban Goka Choa is still part of the cult, but living on his own in New York. The Marines from his unit in Afghanistan are struggling. A soldier appears with a puppy.
2 an extent, pretty much all of us had PTSD. It's somewhere around 20 guys since 2011 who have committed suicide. Both people who were more close to me and then people who were like in my unit as a whole.
One of the primary symptoms of PTSD and associated with combat trauma is paranoia and hyper-awareness, basically.
For Iban, it definitely didn't seem like that was the main driver. It seemed like it was the thoughts that Larry had put in his head, that it's always somebody was out to get him.
When I spoke to Iban, he sounded rational and coherent, and yet he was talking about something that seemed very divorced from reality.
Iban is interviewed by Ezra Marcus. Subtitles, Ezra, did you ever see Larry targeted by governmental forces? While we were in New York, we were definitely being followed. I was a driver for him for a while, and he was being followed on the streets. Sometimes we would see them. Other times we didn't see anything. But there were times where it was obvious that he was being followed.
But there were times where it was obvious that he was being followed.
He was just like, oh, you know, with Larry, Bernard Kerik's still out to get him. It was this paranoid rambling of people associated with Larry who don't like him are out to get Ibon as well.
Ibon sits in dark glasses and a hat at a table by the ocean. The date May 2013 appears over an aerial view of a wooded golf course. Text reads, Larry takes some of his followers out of New York City.
So in spring of 2013, a number of these students go down to North Carolina, where Larry's stepfather, Gordon Ray, lives. And Talia is also living there. And Gordon has a property. It's a large, semi-rural house in Pinehurst, North Carolina, which is a small town. Santos and Dan stay in New York, but the rest of them, Claudia, Yalitza, Felicia, Isabella, are all down in Pinehurst, and they're doing hard labor.
A video of someone digging is shown.
Cult leaders typically exploit their followers in whatever way they can. So it's not surprising that Larry would go that route of getting free labor.
This property is a total mess. Essentially, they rip up all this sod. They have to put new sod down. They have to dig drainage ditches. They have to use backhoes and this machinery, none of which they have any idea how to use. And Larry tells them they have to, like, work all day, and they eat when he tells them to eat, and they can't come inside until this work is done. Here we really see the hierarchy even within the group, where Talia is the most favored among them. So while they're all outside working, she's inside, you know, working on her application to law school. You know, she's not out in the fields.
They got to get it down from the other side, and then you get the water will run inside it. But you believe this overflowed right onto the lawn. Look at this.
Text reads, Larry starts accusing the group of damaging his machinery.
Well, you've been hurting me for so long behind my back, doing damaging things, destroying property.
I don't want to.
Don't want to what?
I don't want to damage things.
Well, when's the last time you damaged something?
Larry had a background of extorting people and financial fraud. He created this whole scene where he convinced them that they broke everything of his, and then he'd come up with these amounts, you know, like thousands of dollars that they supposedly owed him.
I was not trying to.
But if you're trying to damage it and do, then aren't you doing that?
Yes.
We were talking about how much damage I did, and I gave him the estimate of $100,000. And he said, it sounds about right. And I said, it's probably more. And he looks like, yeah, it's probably more.
The group was firmly under Larry Ray's thumb and completely sold on the idea that they owed him this massive debt that they really would never be able to work off.
And these things they'd done became a mechanism for Larry to extract money from their families.
They began to go to their family and friends and tell them that they had done something wrong and that they had to pay him back and that could they help them out.
You know, at one point, the Rosario parents, they weren't especially wealthy. They had managed to save enough money to buy a small house. And they ended up giving six-figure amounts to Larry.
There was one day when Santos was on the phone with Talia about how to get his parents to give him money to make repairs. And occasionally Talia would hand the phone to Larry, and Larry would talk to Santos. It was like a large amount of money, like $20,000, around $20,000. Santos succeeded. And I remember Larry talking to him and saying, good job, see, doesn't that feel better? You know, making repairs is the right thing to do. That kind of thing?
They become profit centers. And Larry Ray is exploiting that. He has them drain the bank accounts of their parents, in some cases, the life savings, because they convince their parents, I have done this kind of damage. I owe this guy this kind of money. I'm in big trouble.
Cars drive along the Hudson River in the evening. Bridges cross the river in the distance. Text reads, upon their return to New York City, Larry demands Claudia pay off her debts.
According to the evidence that was presented, Claudia was in a situation where Larry was demanding thousands and thousands of dollars from her. And he managed to convince her that the only way she could possibly make the kind of money that she needed to make was to begin selling herself.
A blurred reenactment shows a man knocking on a door and a woman answering.
So she began working as a prostitute.
Larry convinced Claudia that she owes him, which at this point is, you know, into the hundreds of thousands of dollars for damaged machinery in Pinehurst. She begins sleeping with men for money, and Larry is, you know, intimately involved, pushing her to set up a website.
Images from Claudia's website appear. Wearing very little, she poses sexily in each one. Prices for her services are listed.
And giving Larry the money.
I wanted to repair what I believe I had done to Larry. And it was because I felt immense pressure from Larry to get money for him.
Exterior nighttime view of an old stone building.
She starts living in hotels, seeing clients in hotels, and any money except what's required to pay rent and for food is all given to Larry.
She was just turned into this like money vehicle. It was no longer a person. She was just going hotel to hotel, working constantly.
The pressure just to make money was just constant and extremely intense. He would threaten to blackmail my clients. He would threaten me physically. He would threaten to put me in prison.
Daytime view of a street of tidy row houses beside a line of trees.
Somebody had found this website that was pretty unsettling, and there was a link to this video.
Speak audibly, Claudia.
Subtitles, I didn't care about other people.
Okay, so say again.
Subtitles, I wanted to poison you and I didn't care about other people.
In that video, Claudia kind of appears to be on autopilot.
Larry Ray would accuse Claudia of things that absolutely made no sense, like poisoning or conspiracies to kill him.
And first, are you making this by your own free will?
Yes.
And if she said anything other than, yes, I did, then Larry would say, but that's not the truth. You have to tell the truth. And these conversations would be recorded. So the truth really meant generating blackmail material.
Subtitles, I poisoned you multiple times with vials of poison.
At the same time, you were trying to convince me that you were a good person and regretted ever doing this and that you would never do it again. Why are we doing that?
Subtitles, so I could continue to have access to you.
So I think by the time she like admits to all these poisonings, she just wants to get out. She just wants to put distance between her and Larry and get out of the situation as fast as possible.
Text reads, Larry uses Isabella to launder Claudia's profits.
The money from Claudia's clients gets transferred to Isabella, and she becomes a crucial part of Larry's operation.
Everyone in a cult, to some degree, becomes a perpetrator. In Isabella's case, she really became sort of the right-hand person to Larry.
She was, in a sense, the bookkeeper for Claudia's prostitution. There were clear accounting ledgers kept that tell us the kind of income that Claudia was producing for Larry.
And yet the amount of money that he says she owes him never seems to go down.
Upward view of a hotel lit blue at night. A woman applies lipstick.
You know, she ends up doing this for 4 years. No holidays. Seeing up to 5 clients a day. And ends up giving him more than $2 million.
Money is handed from one person to another.
She didn't really have anything for herself. She lived in constant fear of Larry punishing her. And it seemed like almost everything she did during that time period was done in order to keep him happy.
Text reads, Iban Goka Choha's despair is also mounting. Fed by Larry's conspiracy theories and paranoia, his mental health takes a turn for the worse.
He was committed to a psychiatric facility.
Which, from his perspective, all that does is reinforce the everyone's out to get me narrative, right? And I'm sure Larry leaned into that. You know, I told you they'd come for you. Like, I don't know, I've been telling you this is gonna happen to you. Now it's happened and you can't trust anyone.
He was kind of like the New Jersey City kid. And I was the, you know, they would call me a mountain goat. And I was always like, no, you gotta come out and experience nature, experience the woods. And my wife and I had been having conversations with him on the phone. We're like, hey, why don't you come move out to Oregon for a bit, see if you can, you know, do something different out here. He seemed, you know, pretty enthusiastic about it and everything. And he got cleared with his medical staff to come out and do it. But we kind of noticed shortly after him getting here, you know, he just seemed like there was no passion for anything. And there was just like nothing that he wanted to do. Oh, I was worried.
A blurred reenactment of people sitting on couches as shown.
For everyone who's in a cult, there are always doubts, but of course you can't express them. You can't say anything to anybody. So you put them on this shelf in the back of your head. And when that shelf breaks, you'll realize this is not healthy. There's something not right here. And then you may start to think about leaving.
Text reads, by 2016, Larry's hold over some of the group starts to wane.
After a while, Daniel just reached a breaking point where he kind of broke through and realized, like, what Larry was sort of presenting as this, you know, enlightenment was just, none of it was real. He was making it up as he was going along. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And shortly after that, he left.
For Santos, I think he had a really hard time reckoning with the idea that Larry, someone that was there for him, someone that listened to him, someone that, like, justified some of his emotions about his family or his parents or his sisters, was actually a really bad person.
At a certain point, Santos essentially hits his limit and stops talking to Larry. He feels abused and he leaves. He sort of gets some low-wage jobs, but he cuts off contact.
The view zooms in on the apartment building. Text reads, Li Chen has waited 6 years for authorities to evict Larry from his Manhattan apartment.
During the eviction process, it took over 3 years to gain a judgment. And then to get the marshal to take action, it took another few years.
Text reads, finally, Larry is forced to leave.
It was finally a big relief to get Larry out of my home.
You know, by this point, he's mostly living on a day-to-day basis with Isabella and Felicia. They spend some time in hotels, they stay in some Airbnbs, and eventually they land at a house in New Jersey owned by his friend, Scott Mueller.
A house under construction with the words, Piscataway, New Jersey, beneath appears. White text on a black background reads, Talia stays in touch from North Carolina.
There were very few spurts that Talia was not in contact every day, but it was practically every day, sometimes multiple times a day, especially with Isabella.
Talia clearly comes out as a key player in the con. She bought it to the point that she sold it to other people and continued to believe the lie throughout the history of this case.
The date October 2018 appears against a hotel. Text reads, Claudia continues to work as an escort in Manhattan. Desperate to leave, she tells one of her clients about Larry's coercion.
This is already years into her being a prostitute. She ended up telling one of her clients in a moment of fear, but also, I think, trying to get out of the situation that she was in. Larry realized that something had happened, and he responds by showing up to one of her hotel rooms.
Larry and Isabella became aware that Claudia had tipped off one of her clients to the fact that they named him on a website exposing his involvement with Claudia, who was a prostitute.
And he responds by showing up to one of her hotel rooms.
Larry and Isabella came to Claudia's hotel room and Larry tortured her over the course of a horrific night of abuse.
He comes in and immediately starts berating her and hitting her and yelling at her for this simple task of trying to tell somebody what was happening to her.
He told me to strip naked. I was physically bound to a chair. I could not leave.
The way that Claudia described it, Isabella was in the room.
I remember her saying that when Larry was pouring water over me and lowering my body temperature, she at one point was like, "Claudia, you're such a faker. This water is room temperature. It's not even cold."
Larry repeatedly suffocated Claudia with a plastic bag. It was relentless, and it was painful, and it was terrifying.
He ended up smothering me, choking me to the point of passing out. I was terrified. I was trembling.
And it's just beyond cruelty. Destroying this perfectly normal student, force her to become a sex worker, and then not only take all the money, but torture her in between.
At a certain point, they even ordered burgers and fries, and, you know, they were eating dinner while she was tied naked to a chair in front of them.
And then the torture started all over again. And at the end of it, he finally unbound her from the chair, let her go. She slept for a few hours. Then she woke up and went back to work.
An air conditioner sits in a hotel window.
And it wasn't very long after that. Claudia showed signs of finally becoming fed up with what she was being put through. And she confided in the same client about what was going on. And he provided her the escape that she desperately needed.
He got her a train ticket. And she left the city. She got away. I mean, this is somebody who was giving, in some cases, over $100,000 a month directly to fund Larry and Isabella. They sent her a series of emails and trying to guilt trip and intimidate her into returning, but she didn't.
And that's the beginning of the end of this story.
Aerial view of a New York building. The date November 2018 appears.
I just started reaching out to people and people that knew Claudia really well, her family and friends, and they were like, none of us have talked to her for 6 years. I pretty soon was put in contact with Daniel Levin. He agreed to talk to me. And that was when it really became clear, like, this was like something really bad and really abusive. I felt like I had to get the story out there to try and get these people some help. So James Walsh and I published the article at the end of April 2019.
Almost a decade from the time that Larry first walked into the dorm at Sarah Lawrence, this piece comes out in New York Magazine, this unbelievably wild tale.
The story came out and we were all in the newsroom and all of us kind of started freaking out because it was a very weird story.
And another repercussion of the publication of the article was that Isabella's mother and aunt and Felicia's mother went to New Jersey and they knocked on the door and they essentially tried to rescue their daughters. Larry apparently hid in the back of the house and the daughters refused to come out. You know, even then, there was nothing that they could really do. These are still adults.
The view pans away from the New Jersey house.
So that New York Magazine article, thankfully, made its way to an FBI supervisor in the New York FBI field office. And that supervisor said, I think we need to look at this. And they proceeded to knock it out of the park, determining how much income Larry Ray had that was from sex trafficking, from depleting the bank accounts of the kids' parents. They acquired cell phone records. Their emails show them being controlled, confessing, now all kinds of things happening and references to violence. Then comes a search warrant of the residence in Piscataway, New Jersey.
The date February 11th, 2020 appears against a view of someone sleeping.
Early in the morning, Larry is in bed and a team of federal agents and NYPD officers come into the house, place him under arrest, and begin interrogating him and going through everything in the house and seizing recordings of thousands of phone calls, videos, several dozen hard drives, several dozen cell phones, laptops, as well as handwritten ledgers and handwritten journals he'd seized from the students.
And it is an agent's dream to have a search where that much documentation of illegality exists. The same documentation used to control and humiliate these kids was the same documentation used in court to absolutely nail Larry Ray.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Berman, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Today, we announce criminal charges against this man, Lawrence Ray, who for nearly a decade exploited and abused young women and men emotionally, physically, and sexually for his own financial gain.
The indictment contained sex trafficking conspiracy, racketeering conspiracy, extortion, money laundering, a vast set of charges.
I heard about Larry being arrested on just a like a Google News alert. Just popped up and said he was arrested, and so I was worried about what Yvonne might do. Just because of his level of devotion towards him, that this looked like, in Larry's world, the culmination of everyone's trying to get me, now they got him. And I had no idea, you know, what he had put in his head, what he should do.
Exterior nighttime view of a house with a porch light on.
I went to bed, and then about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, knock on the door, and this Linn County Sheriff's deputy. He initially asks if I know someone named Iban, because he obviously doesn't know how to pronounce his name. And I was thinking, oh crap, what did he do? But then he is asking about his tattoos or if he has any identifiable markers. So now I'm like, okay, like what's going on? And he gets to the point and he's like, oh, he was found dead.
The friend grows emotional. Yvonne sits by the ocean in a picture.
Now, to my knowledge, Yvonne tried to slit his wrists and was unsuccessful, and then got up and walked into traffic and laid down on a highway.
Yvonne lies on a bed with a dog snuggled at his side. Maple trees grow in a dense forest. Light filters through the leaves. Yvonne's friend stands looking around.
And it seemed like Yvonne created like a rabbit hole for himself that he couldn't get out of with that paranoia. At the end of the day, I think that it's all on Larry. I think that if it wasn't for him, Yvonne, you know, he might still have mental health struggles, but not to that degree. I absolutely blame Larry 100% for Yvonne's death.
Text reads, as they build their case against Larry, investigators turn to his followers.
Felicia was talking to the government, but she still essentially was on Larry's side. And then at a certain point, she kind of came to a realization and began actually cooperating and turned on Larry. Santos, he was played videos of what Larry had done to him, and then he just realized, like, I'm being abused, and he began cooperating as well. So Felicia, Santos, Yalitza, Claudia, and Dan, they all handed over documents and spent innumerable hours talking to the government. Isabella was initially described as a victim. The government was hoping that she would also flip, probably expecting that she would, and she didn't.
Larry's face stares out. The date March 2022 appears against a view of New York.
Headlines for you, this out of New York. A dad accused of running a sex cult from his daughter's dorm room. Remember this? He's due in court in the next half hour.
Ray is charged with 9 counts, including extortion, money laundering, and sex trafficking. Prosecutor called Ray a flight risk and a danger to the community.
The government described Talia and Gordon Ray, Larry's stepfather, as co-conspirators, but neither have been charged.
Talia is the ultimate true believer because not only has she continued to stick by her father is a blood relative. And I think that may have figured into the prosecutive decisions here. The idea of charging a daughter for believing her father's lies, going back all the way to childhood, it could be too much for a jury. Just distracting from the case at hand.
Larry appears to have essentially insulated his immediate family from the most incriminating parts of what he was doing. He had Isabella recording information about the money coming from Claudia, which makes her a direct accessory.
Text reads, Isabella Pollock was charged with 16 felony counts, including sex trafficking, forced labor, and money laundering. Talia Ray did not attend her father's trial. People wearing heavy coats walk to a court building and enter.
Where there's a trial and people have to get up on the stand and talk about what they experienced, what they saw, what happened to them. I can't think of anything that could be harder, really.
The victims are filmed wearing COVID masks and entering the court building. Each is accompanied by a team of people.
First of all, you have to sit there in front of your abuser. You probably haven't seen that person in perhaps years. To have that person looking at you, trying to shut you up with their eyes. They deserve awards because they're helping bring these people down.
Larry Ray's trial was a jury trial. So you've got to convince a group of citizens beyond a reasonable doubt that these cult members were truly against their will, unable to consent to what was done to them.
Larry recorded everything and we got to watch it. And it was really hard to watch because Larry's physically beating them.
The more I heard, the more I realized that Larry Ray was far more of a demon than anyone ever imagined.
I think the problem for the defense was, no matter how you spin this, you're facing incredibly damaging videos of your client physically harming people.
Text reads, the victims take the stand.
The witnesses were remarkably composed, considering what they had gone through and the nature of what they were describing for the jury, the torture, the humiliation, the shame.
So imagine we're this incredibly vulnerable person who was part of this and having to talk about what happened and what was done to you and to say that publicly. That's hard. That's tough.
Claudia really had a pretty high burden because she was a sex trafficking victim. So it was not easy, I'm sure, for her to sit there and recount in laborious detail all of the things that had happened to her.
All of a sudden, as Claudia is describing being a forced prostitute, one of Larry's lawyers stands up and asks for a break. And usually during testimony, that doesn't really happen.
He seems to go through some kind of seizure in the courtroom right there. And he has to be carried out of the courthouse on a stretcher.
And he's making like eye contact with people. Like he's trying to like see who's there, how many people are around him as he gets pulled into the ambulance. In the witness room, you can audibly hear Claudia crying as we're all walking out, trying to figure out what's happening.
And I said, I know him. I know exactly what he's doing. He's trying to influence the jury. He's trying to create this self-pity thing. I said, he's doing it on purpose.
Larry is loaded into the ambulance. Text reads, several days later, the trial resumes with Claudia's testimony. Larry has another seizure.
As with anything related to Larry, you have to expect some kind of curveball. I mean, is he going to be able to, like, somehow, at the last minute, like, prolong this so that the victims no longer want to testify or they're unsettled? And what happens? You know, it didn't end up working. There were two seizures and then there weren't any more.
Paramedics enter the ambulance. White text on a black background reads, after a four-week trial, the prosecution rests its case.
In all, the jury only deliberated for 4 hours, which for a trial that lasted a month, and for as many counts as he was accused of, kind of speaks to where the jury was before they even got to the verdict room.
It didn't take the jury very long to come back with a unanimous verdict that Larry was guilty on all counts.
They knew it was coming. The court testimony was overwhelming. I knew he would be convicted.
There is justice for the victims. They wanted Larry to get arrested and indicted and convicted, and I think it was really powerful for them. They could now resume their lives.
And they say justice has been served for him.
The Metropolitan Detention Center, Brooklyn Federal Prison, appears.
There's nothing harsh enough that could happen to him based on what he did to those kids.
There certainly have been other evil cult leaders, but the extent of what he did and the amount of time he was allowed to do it with such concentration and precision, that was almost beyond anything I've heard of.
I don't think there's an ounce of regret. He just destroyed people's lives. He loved feeling powerful. I would almost call him a power addict.
The way that you can judge other people is how they treat other humans. Just a horrific individual.
Aerial view of Sarah Lawrence College.
There's this inevitable question of why nothing was done earlier. The guilt that must be felt not only by Sarah Lawrence administrators, but the guilt of the victim's parents must be painful.
I have no trouble blaming Sarah Lawrence for letting somebody move into the dorm. What was Sarah Lawrence to do? They could have made sure he got out of the dorm, but I'm not sure had they gotten him out of the dorm sooner, anything would have been different. The really troublesome stuff happens later at the apartment on the Upper East Side.
Larry Ray was one of the most skilled con artists I've seen in 25 years. There may not have been much more that you could have done.
I think the biggest question about this case is why Larry Ray did what he did.
In terms of what drove him, I don't know if it's as simple as he wanted money and sex, although I think he certainly did. He was like somebody who, for decades, was able to carve out a space for himself outside of the typical rules where he could exploit people's vulnerabilities. And it was these exact same tools which eventually led to his downfall, because he recorded his own crimes.
Part of his defense was that he really believed the conspiracy and that these kids were bad actors working for Bernie Kerik. Whether he believed it or not, it's hard to say why he would ever and how he could torture these young people so extensively in the ways that he did.
Images of the victims appear with text beneath each. Text reads, Daniel Levin has published a memoir of his time with Larry Ray, Slonim Woods 9. Felicia finished her residency and is now practicing medicine. Santos and Yalitza Rosario have been reunited with their family. Claudia has been reunited with her family. She declined to be interviewed. Her lawyer asked, we recognize she is a real person who is so much more than what Larry Ray did to her. Talia Ray was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in U.S. v. Ray, but never charged with a crime. She declined to be interviewed. Isabella Pollack pleaded guilty to conspiring to launder money. She declined to be interviewed. Larry Ray is awaiting sentencing. He faces up to 120 years in prison. If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health, suicide or substance use crisis or emotional distress, reach out to 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, formerly known as the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Dial or text 988 or use chat services at suicidepreventionlifeline.org to connect to a trained crisis counselor. Peacock Media Productions, LLC. All rights reserved.